Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with greed. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. How's your October going? You having a good time? A lot of people out there are not having a good time right now. The seasons are changing. It's bringing with it a lot of that seasonal affective disorder, and I gotta admit, I'm feeling it quite a lot myself. I've talked about this on the show a couple of times now. I went to see a therapist because things had just gotten to the point where my tools were no longer sharp enough to cut through the fog anymore. And so now here we are in, the middle of October, I guess, and I'm still feeling it. In fact, my overall bipolar disorder is through the roof/floor. The low lows have gotten to the point where I don't know how to see the end of them when they come on. And I know there will be. I've gone through this enough to know how it all works. But then the high highs hit. And they're awesome. That's the nature of mania. That's the nature of being bipolar. If you got bipolar 1, like me, if you got bipolar 2, then my heart goes out to you. Because, man, those low lows, it doesn't get any harder than that. But I'll tell you this. I've been taking a lot of stock in my own personal journey on all of this. And I think I've decided that I'm going to go back to the therapist and I'm going to try a mild medication and see if that does the trick. I had someone put it to me in a way that finally made sense. And it was, you may not have to be on it forever, but if your brain can't make the right chemicals, store-bought is fine. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Okay. I mean, I preach about going and getting the help that you need, going on medication if you need it, removing the stigma, all of those things. Those are things that I talk about, and I believe them wholeheartedly. So why am I having such a difficulty doing that myself? Why? I guess it's because, ultimately, I still feel, personally, that if I can't manage this on my own, then I'm not doing it right. Or if I can't manage it on my own, it's a weakness. I don't know why I think that. I do know why I think that. It's years and years of conditioning and societal pressure. It's all of those things. But you can be a thing you don't want. And I don't want to be bipolar. And yet, here we are. You know, much like someone who loses a limb can not want to be a person with a missing limb. Here you are. There's a reality that is undeniable to that. It just so happens the limb that I'm missing is the part of my brain that makes everything work correctly. So, I guess it's time to get some store-bought sunshine for the old noggin. I guess we'll see how that goes. Speaking of sunshine in your noggin, today on the show I have got Nathan Lund. He's a comedian. He's an interesting guy. He's a podcaster, and you should definitely check out his podcast, One on Lund, and give it a listen. He is a really fascinating character, and we get into it pretty heavily on this show here. So listen to this show and then go listen to that show. And let them know we sent you. But we have a really great conversation about all kinds of things, about getting to know yourself, about confidence, about taking those first steps to make a decision about the kind of person that you want to be versus the kind of person you are. And I think there's no greater segue than that. Ladies and gentlemen, here is my conversation with Nathan Lund.
Yeah, I like to be able to hear myself so I know I'm not blowing it like that. I caught it, so that's good.
Well, that's staying in.
Is it there or there?
Yeah, right there. Yeah, perfect. Okay. All right, awesome. Well, hey, how's it going, man?
Pretty good.
Great.
Solid day. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. My first exposure to you was at when I first moved out here. I was trying to do stand-up because I was a drummer and I had nowhere to put my drums. And so I needed something to do. And I'm not real good on the guitar. And so it was like, I'll try to write jokes. And so you were the regular host at the open mic at the Three Kings.
Yeah. I still do that.
Yeah, exactly. There was another guy the last time I was there. Okay, I got up impromptu for the first time in 3 years, maybe a month ago.
Oh, okay.
I was there to play in a band that night, and I just thought, I'll get on the list and I'll see if they'll let me do 2 minutes.
Did you get up?
Yeah, I did.
How was it?
It was fine. It worked. I was rusty for sure, but you know, I was happy to do it. It felt good.
Yeah.
In fact, I've been thinking about it more lately too. I've been thinking about it in terms of I have a lot of recordings of like the first hour of material that I wrote. And it's all embarrassing and terrible. And so
yeah,
I wanted something that I could remember fondly, like something that I actually wrote that I liked, that I can show people and not be so embarrassed. But so when did you start doing comedy?
I started in 2004. I graduated college in Reno and wasn't sure what I wanted to do next. I didn't want to go to graduate school, so I knew I needed to get a job, and I had just had this itch to try stand up for maybe a year, less than a year, before I finally did it. And my last semester of college, I wrote stuff down and tried to think of what I would want to do on stage before doing it. And I figured, I didn't know anything about the Reno scene, but I figured it was small, and so I just waited until I moved back to Henderson, Nevada, which is right next to Las Vegas. I figured Las Vegas would have a lot of different open mics and more of a scene. And so, yeah, I waited. And when I got down there, I saw my buddy Jacob play in a band at a bar, and it just had a good stage. And I thought, oh, maybe they do comedy. So I called and asked them like a week later, and they said they didn't do comedy, but I could come down and do a set before they had music. And and like an idiot, I was like, oh, sounds good. And I went down there, and the stage was being renovated, so that was, you know, a great omen for for how comedy works.
Yeah.
So I just had to be like right next to the bar, you know, just no stage. There was a wall of TVs behind me, and despite all of that, I had a really, really fun first time. A bunch of my friends came and were very supportive and laughed, and so even though I wasn't on a stage and there weren't other comics, it was still a pretty good first time.
Yeah.
I was pretty lucky to have...
You made it work.
Yeah, well, and I was lucky to have a bunch of friends come that first time, and I had friends come, you know, for my first handful of times or whatever. I had a good amount of friends that wanted to check me out at first, and then, you know, they start to dwindle away as you get better, which is, you know, just another funny way that stand-up goes. As you get better, the longer you've been doing it, typically the less people that you have come out, and until you start getting to do cooler shows, and then you know, friends are more likely to come out.
Yeah, friends are tough because your friends, they love you and they like you and they want you to succeed, but they don't necessarily respect you.
Oh yeah, no.
So you know, they see you do your thing and they go, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. And I was lucky. My friends were supportive and laughed, and I felt good. But I wasn't good. You know, most people aren't when they start. You know, I had an inkling of what I wanted to do for that first time because, like I said, I wrote for a while first. But I wasn't, you know, polished. I wasn't aware of, you know, how you're supposed to compose yourself and all of that, all of the little ins and outs. And so... You know, that came over the course of... I spent 4 years in Las Vegas, my first 4 years, doing stand-up there. And then I moved up here to Denver in 2008.
Wow. So you already had 4 years under your belt before you even got here.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice to be able to have had a lot of the new things kind of figured out. It was still... you know, tough to navigate a new scene, and I hadn't had any experience with a comedy club before I moved here. You know, so the Comedy Works, Comedy Works was new, a new thing for me to have to call in and to have to try and stand out to get 2 minutes. You know, for your first time, and to kind of just join the pecking order, you know, or to join that giant pool of comics trying to get spots at the club. That was new. Because, yeah, in Vegas, there were all these, you know, clubs, but they were all established, you know, and professional, and they didn't have new talent night like Comedy Works.
Yeah.
There wasn't a contest that brand new comics could enter. It was all just kind of, hey, you know, the Improv, Tropicana, a couple other places were 7 days a week. They'd book, you know, host, opener, headliner. And they were all, you know, professional road comics. And so, yeah, there wasn't that really a good in until, like, right before I moved, a couple of newer clubs opened up. And so the guys that were still down there when I moved got to get into a couple of clubs. You know, it got a little bit easier because when I was down there, it was mostly just, you know, a couple open mics at bars and a couple of booked shows, and... None of them were super well attended or supported or whatever. It was all very much kind of the comics supporting each other and being the audience. And so,
wait a minute, they were the audience and they were supportive?
The comics? Well, we had to be, and we weren't very good at being a supportive audience, you know.
Yeah.
But there was still that camaraderie of, hey, that I really like that new thing, or.
Yeah.
That was a really good set. There was that. And there was kind of a, just, you know, like I said, a camaraderie where we all were excited to be doing this. One of my big things was people constantly telling me that stuff that I came up with was on Curb Your Enthusiasm. It happened like 5 or 6 times. I didn't watch it. I didn't have HBO.
Yeah.
And so I was unaware every time. And somebody would come up and be like, hey, do you watch Curb? And I'm like, damn. Not again. there was a lot of that.
So what was the flavor of your original stuff?
I was a lot more dark or edgy or dirty, whatever you know, all of those things. I think a lot of comics start out with less. Well, I mean, you know, you don't know what your voice is, and
right.
So you go for certain. Established comics styles, and
you do like a pastiche almost.
Yeah, right, yeah. And so, and I felt like because these open mics were difficult, because there weren't a lot of crowd members, and if anybody was at these shows, these open mics, they were typically gambling. They weren't there to watch comedy, to support.
Yeah.
So I think that made me feel like I needed to be shocking to get people's attention, to make them, you know, listen to me or turn around from, you know, from the video poker machine at the bar. And I, my hope was that people would hear me swearing or being, you know, anti-religious or whatever, and then feel like I was also pretty smart, you know, not,
yeah,
not just bluntly vulgar, but intelligent and a little bit, evil. and I loved, still love Doug Stanhope. A lot of comics in Vegas worshipped.
Oh yeah.
Stanhope. And so he was, is and was very much that, you know, edgy, very smart, clever, irreverent. And over the years, I have moved away from that in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I got tired of trying to shock people, or, you know, my first thing is to try and have fun and spread some cheer, you know, some joy. And so I started over the years, and when I moved here, I started to become a lot more silly than edgy.
Yeah.
And I don't swear as much. I don't need to, for most of my jokes to work. I don't incorporate as much foul language.
Yeah.
As kind of, I mean, mostly just for my own well-being, you know, to not be this, like, to put out this tortured, you know, artist thing. It's more, hey, let's have some fun. And yeah, I'm not trying to walk people, you know, by challenging them. It's more, let's have a good time if you like me. Maybe, you know, as I become more of a headliner where I might know a lot of the audience, or if they know me at all, then I might be able to be a little more honest with dark stuff or with my thoughts on things. But it's hard to do that when you're on, you know, a show with a bunch of other comics.
Right.
To kind of change people's minds about stuff, you know, in 10 minutes. So I mostly go for some silly wordplay, and
yeah,
I smoke weed and I have a dog, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you can't go wrong with stuff like that. But the other thing about that too, is that coming from whatever word you like for it, you know, it's that artistic process of getting to know yourself and expressing yourself through that material. Honestly, even if what you're saying isn't a thing that actually happened to you,
mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily have to tell a true story, but you have to tell a story truthfully.
Right.
And if you're not, people are going to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah, they tune out. They don't. Yeah. You got to be. Yeah, you want people to believe you.
Yeah.
Even if what you're saying is completely ridiculous.
Yes, exactly. You have to find a way in.
You and sell them.
It's a lot easier to do if you like the person that you're. That you are on stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what kind of person were you when you were a kid? Like, what was little Nathan like that led up to the look at me syndrome?
Yeah. I am still the oldest. So there was a little bit of that look at me when my sister and brother came along. We're all close in age. My sister's 2 years younger than me, but my brother's 3 years younger than me. So we were all pretty competitive for attention, and I was competitive with my classmates. There were a lot of us that were good at school, good at sports, and so we were all pretty competitive for attention, for accolades or whatever. I was pretty hard on myself in school, harder than my parents were on me. They didn't need to, you know, remind me that I needed to study or whatever. I liked sports. I liked music and movies and comedy. You know, Comedy Central came around, I think, in like 1990,
yeah,
maybe 91 or whatever. It was
right around there. Yeah,
yeah. I remember watching it when I was pretty young, you know, 10 or 11, and really appreciating it from a young age, and also kind of understanding that that it was a kind of power for attention or for accolades if you could crack up your friends. You know, it went a long way, and we could be brutal to each other. You know, it was like we were always our class was always hanging out in school, and a lot of us after school. And so we would take turns just ostracizing each other for little things, you know, missteps and misspeaking. It could, you know, could get you ditched. You know, we'd all be on our bikes, and all of a sudden, everybody was trying to ditch you, and it was brutal. It was, you know, I mean, yeah. Kids can be the worst. And so, luckily, for the most part, that didn't happen often to the core group of friends, you know, so it wasn't like a constant fear, but there was definitely something that could keep you in everybody's good graces by being funny, you know, and cracking each other up.
Yeah.
And I also saw it in my, the power it had on my dad, cause he would be tired from work, grumpy a lot of the time, short temper, didn't talk to us kids very much. But we could, you know, watch comedy and laugh, and it softened him a lot. And
yeah.
So I saw that, and I didn't just immediately want to do stand-up, but I saw that there was power in comedy and making people laugh. And but it wasn't until, like I said, college, where I finally thought maybe I should try it. You know, people had told me that I was funny from when I was a kid, but it didn't feel like an option
right.
to, like, pursue comedy as a career. Until I was almost done with college, and I thought, well, yeah, I mean, I could try it. I could write stuff down. Enough people had made me feel good about being funny,
yeah.
To where I thought, okay, yeah, maybe I can give it a try. And I was hooked from that first time. I wanted to do it from that first time. I've thought about quitting only a small handful of times in 14 years, and so it's nice to not constantly feel like a fraud. It's more just like, yeah, no, you just
yeah.
keep doing it and see what happens.
Do you get that imposter syndrome very much in any other areas of your life?
Oh, yeah. there's just so much that you can do that you're not, you know, to help
yeah.
other people, to help yourself, to make money, to save money, to all the right things that you're supposed to do. And I'm not good at most of them. I'm not a model citizen. I'm not a great... upstanding, you know, I vote and that's about it. And
sure.
I wish I volunteered. I wish I'd knocked on doors and tried to help more than I do. But
yeah, but I mean, that's not necessarily for everybody. I mean, there are a lot of roles that a lot of people can have, and you know, there's nothing wrong with a clown.
Right. Yeah. I try to make myself feel better by saying, you know, I do try to help people by making them laugh. And
no, absolutely.
I try to, you know, I donate, you know, I do fundraiser shows. I donate my time and my jokes to benefit shows, you know, whenever I can. And so, yeah, there's little things, but you know what I mean?
There's
so much more that I could be doing. I know that I couldn't do it all without being exhausted or whatever, but some people are just so tireless and so good at giving and at helping that, you know, I wish I could do more. And my goal as I try to become, a bigger comic, a more successful comic, is to give back and to help others.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's definitely a noble goal,
mm-hmm.
but the other piece of that, on the other side is essentially your only line in the sand for where you have to be as a human being to be helpful to the world is to just try most of the time to not be an asshole.
Sure. Yeah, I know. The bare minimum is a very low bar.
If you think about it, just don't be a jerk to people.
Sure.
And... try to be decent.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, above and beyond. And when you can, be really great.
Yeah.
But
yeah, there's a lot of people that fall short of that bare minimum. And so
sure.
a lot of us, yeah, like you're saying, it is kind of like you're selling yourself short if you are above and beyond that bare minimum, because not everybody can even do that. And some people, you know, they can't. Some people could. but they're, you know, but they're caught up in their own head or whatever.
I think that's exactly it.
So, yeah, so there, I can feel okay about being a decent person, trying to help people, trying to exhibit, you know, kindness or patience or, you know, those things. And so that does make me feel better.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've also, you know, it's a process of trying to be that all the time, not having any real periods or stretches where you're not that, you
yeah.
know, and so I think I've been better about that as I get older. You know, it's tougher when you're younger. I think you feel like the main character.
And sure.
And so you forgive yourself for things or whatever, or you can explain things away. And then as you get older, you realize we're all supporting characters. And so you kind of, you know, can't justify being selfish, you know. And you, I think a lot of people become better team players the older they get.
Yeah.
Ideally, you get better.
Ideally.
At being a person.
Yeah. No, I've definitely seen it happen the other way,
yeah.
where people really dig in and they become bitter
yeah.
as they age. Mm-hmm. And that's not cute.
No. You know? Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and that kind of feels like a fictional archetype that people think is just fine to take on. The curmudgeon that eventually will redeem themselves
yeah.
or that people know deep down is a good person, but it's like, no, that's fake. And that's that's in books and movies. And
right. Everyone wants to believe they're Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. You're making people miserable and you're not changing.
Right.
So it's not
that guy you were just awful to is not going to be around for the reveal.
Right. Yeah. Right.
All,
you can't,
all he knows is this.
You can't keep pushing the reveal or the metamorphosis further and further out, because then you're staying the same and you're just negatively affecting people all the time. And you're just making it seem like eventually you'll be a good person. And yeah, you can't do that, and you can't go for the deathbed change of heart.
Yeah,
because if everybody did that, everybody would die at the same time. It would all go right. to shit.
so I mean, it sounds like you've got your empathy on lock, but that is a harder thing for a human being to come to. And I also think that a lot of the comedians that I know and that I talk to, they tend to get it a lot sooner than
yeah.
a lot of other people, just because there's I feel like what makes you a person who's good at comedy, those very same skills are what make you good at relating to other people in the mm. first place, even if it's mm-hmm. from a strange, one-sided visitor in the world kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But when did you come to that realization that being stuck in your own head wasn't going to serve you?
I don't know. 'Cause when I first moved here, it was exciting to be a part of this new scene that had a club, a club that wanted to foster new talent, and open mics that people enjoyed going to, that non-comics went to. All of that newness was very exciting, and I befriended a few new comics. Kevin O'Brien and Bobby Crane were both brand new, and we fell, we fell into lockstep for a while, and kind of enjoyed. I kind of felt like a new comic with them, because the 4 years in Vegas weren't the same as 4 years here. Even
yeah.
when I moved here, there was something special happening, and there were great comics, and the club was, you know, was trying to provide direction and tips, and there were older comics that were helping the newer comics. And so I got to feel still, you know, new and, mm-hmm. and learning all these things. And a lot of that, the new excitement is pretty selfish, because it's like, you know, you're excited, you feel like a rock star, and people are complimentary, and you get free drinks or you win bar tabs. And so there was still a lot of just kind of selfish partying, celebrating, hey, this is so fun. And a lot of comics do that when they're new, and then you know, hopefully you grow out of it. I started to take it more seriously after those first few years where I kind of, I don't know, realized that I was going to need to keep working in order to keep up with the hard workers, with the solid writers. You know, I couldn't just be new guy to Denver that had 4 years under his belt. That wasn't going to be enough,
right,
to keep me, you know, feeling like I was maturing or whatever. And so I started to get better about it, but it was still tough because you're balancing those, the humility of there's a million people funnier and better at this than me, but I still, you know, belong, or you know, I as long as I continue to evolve, then I shouldn't feel like I'm an imposter, like you said. You want the humility, but you need some bravado, you need some ego to feel like, hey, everybody in this room should listen to me. I'm funny, I'm talented, you know. So it's a balancing act, and I wasn't real good at it for the first 4 years I was here, you know. It was
just another 4 years.
It was peaks and valleys. There were peaks and valleys where sometimes I would feel like I was on the right track, and then other times I would feel like I kind of meandered down the party path. I quit drinking 2 years ago, and that was huge. Before that, I was getting better at treating it like a career, and getting. And maintaining focus. But it wasn't until I quit drinking that it was like pretty serious, like, all right, you gotta stop. It's too much. It was dragging me down, weighing me down.
Well, this city is a drinking. Really, really good enabler for that.
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
This is probably the drinkiest city I've ever been in.
Yeah.
But the thing that I'm always struck by, and I think this is where people start getting into trouble, is that it's a city that does it casually very well.
Sure.
And I kind of think that that's actually also its downfall, because you see people who are managing it,
mm-hmm.
and you go, well, they're fine.
Oh,
they
yeah.
can do it.
Yeah.
And then you're seeing it live out right in front of you. Like the place that I came from was a little town in Michigan, and people didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have let's have two and go home.
Yeah.
They had let's black out.
Yeah.
On, you know, natural ice in a cornfield or something, you know, like
yeah.
that was it. There was either you drink to get wasted or you don't drink.
Right. Yeah, there's a competitive, mostly manly, but also just, you know, women can get sucked into it too, where it's competitive. It's like a talent. It's like a sign of being mature.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like I said, like we were saying, tough or good at something. Good at drinking meant you could drink a ton, and it didn't really matter how wasted or how sloppy you get, as long as you put it in, you know? And
yeah.
There's almost something that's celebrated about throwing up and continuing to drink, or being super hungover the next day, but continuing to drink.
Sure.
That turns into toughness or, like a talent.
It's a real meathead vibe.
You know? Yeah. It's very base. And I grew up outside of Chicago and saw that with my dad's friends and older kids. We moved when I was 12, but it was still there. And then in Henderson in Las Vegas, it's still a thing, you know, partying or whatever, being able to party. And it felt, you know, that was a sign of being an adult, was partying and drinking. And then college was that, you know.
Yeah.
It's when I didn't drink a lot in high school, but those parties, you know, you wanted to impress the older kids and the guys in that weren't in high school anymore. If you got to go to those parties, you got to see the evolution of hard drinking. And I went from college drinking to stand-up drinking, and they were both very dangerous and unhealthy or whatever.
Yeah.
And like you said, some people are better at it than others, and so it doesn't affect them the same way. It doesn't affect any of us the same exact way every time or over the years or whatever. So
Well, yeah, it's a wiring thing. Some people are just wired that they don't have that thing in their head that says stop.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't have it. I mean, my dad was a really committed alcoholic for a number of years, and he couldn't shut it off.
Yeah.
And so he quit, and he became a substance abuse counselor, and who would know better?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
You can trust him a lot more, a little bit more than somebody who never touched it. And,
sure.
And still, I mean, they still want to help people, but they can't understand the same way.
Yeah.
I guess if it was close to them, if their parent or close friend or partner were really bad, then you get a taste of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, going through it yourself, I think, is, you know, the best way to be able to help others through it.
The thing that worked for me in that regard, because I can still drink casually.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I got it in me,
mm-hmm.
so I try to be really careful about it because I know it's there.
Yeah.
In fact, so I've got bipolar disorder as well. So that's, I know that, if things are going really well, a drink can be a celebration. Mm-hmm. And if things are going really poorly, it's like, oh, I need to unwind. It's like, if you start using it like a tool, it starts becoming a crutch.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like when I was trying to do stand up, back when I still thought I was going to do that, I learned pretty quickly, I don't want to drink on stage. Cause I saw way too many people just, they drink for the courage and then they get on stage. And now not only are they terrible, but they're not going to remember why they were terrible and fix it.
Sure.
And so I didn't want to be that guy.
Yeah, I had a lot of that too. Starting out, it made it easier to get up there, and it is a balancing act because if you go too far beforehand, it affects. Especially when you're new, you don't have, it's not muscle memory, so you can't stay on top of it as easily. Yeah. It goes to waste, and I realized that. That drinking was affecting my stand up when we were still doing Too Much Fun, the Fine Gentleman's Club, we did that every Wednesday, and this guy Oliver was recording the show, and the first time I sat down and listened to some of the recordings, there were like 2 months worth or whatever, and I couldn't believe how I sounded buzzed, I sounded a little slurred. I was surprised at how much material I repeated over those 2 months. Cause the four of us that ran the show always kind of felt like we needed to not do that, that we couldn't do the same jokes every week. Cause a lot of people came every week.
Yeah.
So we didn't want them to get tired of us. Well, I was pretty surprised at how much I was unconsciously doing a lot of the same jokes. And so that sucked. I felt like I was wasting a great, weekly stage time in front of a killer crowd. So I tried to be better about it after that. Well, I wasn't always easy because it was a party every week, it was free and we wanted people to come and drink and have a good time. So it was hard not to get sucked up into that aspect of it. But I think, I was able to get a little bit better about it after hearing my sets. And thinking, oh God, it's just a lot of times it probably wasn't super obvious for people that were watching or listening, but to know myself, I just thought, all right, I gotta try to reel it in a little bit. And I think I got better about it for a while. And I stopped drinking before we ended the show. So the last like 6 months or whatever, I wasn't drinking at all.
Yeah.
And it was nice. It was nice to be able to feel more focused, to not get caught up in the fun, drinking, loose atmosphere.
Hard realization to come to.
Yeah.
So, where were you at when you made the decision, this just isn't going to be sustainable for me, even though there's going to be a lot of people around me who think it's sustainable for them?
Well, So 2 years ago, I was 34, and it was a lot harder to bounce back after drinking a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Just getting older makes it tougher. And so that the physical part sucked, where like the next day it's just, man, like sometimes I wouldn't feel normal or not hungover until after my set, you know, the following night. You know, it was just all day, just felt terrible. And then collect myself and shower or whatever, go do a set, and then probably have a couple beers, and then I wouldn't feel terrible. So that, it just felt like a big waste of my day, every day. And I was worried that there was going to be a time where I was going to drink enough to forget I had a show that night or have a really bad set. I mean, that happened, you know, plenty.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But something like catastrophic, something really big. And again, there was one night I'm thinking of right now. You mentioned Ben Roy. I opened for him at a show once and got blackout before my set. And it was terrible, you know, just rambled, started the same jokes a couple times, got into it with a couple of audience members because they either heckled or, you know, rightly booed or whatever it was.
Or you thought they did.
yeah, I don't even, yeah, right. It was very bad, and it was so long ago. I wish I would have learned my lesson then. But, you know, if anything, I was probably temporarily better about it, more conscious of it, and then slid back into just kind of forgiving myself or whatever. And so it was a culmination of years of wanting to slow down and realizing it was going to be very hard to just, you know, change, like you said, change my wiring.
Yeah.
To stop after a couple, or to drink slower, or to keep track of how many drinks I had had. All of those things were very foreign to me.
Yeah.
And so eventually I realized it was going to be way better for me if I stopped than to continue to try and, you know, drink a moderate amount.
Right.
And it has been. It's way easier.
I
don't miss wondering at the beginning of the night how the rest of the night was going to unfold, because for the most part I was a happy drunk, and a lot of people were surprised when I quit because they didn't know how much it affected me and how much it affected my relationships. But it did, you know, and it was just a roll of the dice on whether I would be, you know, out of control.
Yeah.
And for the most part, like I said, I wasn't. But there were times when I was, and it sucked, you know. And
well, so, you can be out of control in a way that's, you know, completely fun.
Yeah.
And completely acceptable socially. You can be completely out of your mind and still be somebody's problem.
Right. Yeah.
Like, even if it's fun, you can still be somebody's problem pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it sounds like you had somebody in your life that was helpful.
Yeah, my girlfriend, Megan, quit drinking 5 months before me. And I wanted to quit when she did. I thought about it, but it just still seemed like it would be very hard.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if I could do it, and I didn't think I was ready, and it was the beginning of April. And so I thought about the summer, like, oh, I'm not going to drink all summer, whatever. It was
what
just,
am I going to do?
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to be bored. Sam Talent got married that June, and I was like, oh, how could I not drink at my best friend's wedding?
Yeah.
Which, again, is stupid, you know, but I was still just in that mindset of, oh, it would be super hard, and I should do it eventually, but now isn't the right time or whatever. But 5 months later, I was finally ready, and so it was helpful that Megan had already quit.
Yeah.
Because I was really proud of her and happy for her. And we drank differently. I was a lot more social. She was a lot more reclusive, and her drinking was a lot more pain management. Mm-hmm. Mine was social, competitive, you know.
Sure.
Social hierarchy kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it was different. And so I kind of thought, well, you know, she needed to quit. Maybe I don't need to. And then eventually it was like, yeah, no, I do need to. We both need to. We will both be better off. And we have been.
Yeah.
The positive effects are immediate.
Yeah.
You know, you think, like you said, with the brain, you think that you need to drink to feel less shitty.
Yeah.
Because your brain is wired to think that it's a good, you know, it's a pleasurable thing. You're pouring, you know, feel good chemicals onto your brain. But when you remove it, then your brain can start to be better and happy and functioning on its own. And without all the negative effects of the drinking, it's a little easier for your baseline to be, you know, you're less in pain or you're less tired or whatever. Those feelings of dependency, if you can get past them, it feels good, you know?
Yeah.
I know that we were lucky because it's not easy for a lot of people to quit, and some people never do and never can, or, you know, so I never want to make it sound like everybody could just quit. And,
right.
And I tried to quit several times.
Yeah.
And then realized it was going to be hard, or convince myself I didn't need to, convince myself that, you know, 3 months or 6 months was a great amount of time to stop.
Yeah.
And that it was okay to go back to it, because like you said, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And a lot of people
are
very good at, they're good at stopping before they black out, or stopping after a few because they feel full. Some people have told me that their stomach starts to hurt, and so they stop drinking. And I was like, I wish that was me. I don't remember that ever being the case. We're like, ooh, my tummy hurts. I should
knock
it off. But
those people still want to drink with you.
Yeah.
Like, even knowing that, they're like, yeah, I'm going to have a couple. Why don't you just do that? It's like, well, yeah, you don't understand. Like, it's a completely different, you know, they're saying now even that people's diets aren't even compatible, as far as like they're starting to finally figure it out. There's not one way to do it. There's just physically nothing that's going to work for everybody. And it's the same with any kind of substances or anything. Like, I know that I can't do cigarettes or coke or speed or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because those really work on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I like those a lot.
Right. Yeah.
And so, because they keep me alert, they keep me awake. I mean, that's why coffee came in and saved the day.
Yeah.
Because it was like, well, I can still do this. And that's what it was for a while. I got competitive with caffeine like a maniac because I didn't even know how to handle that. But
yeah.
I just learned that, oh, these are things that are just off limits for me.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I know people that can say, ah, it's my brother's wedding, I'm going to do a line of coke. I'm like, you're fucking out of your mind. But, you know, good for you, weekend warrior. I'm not that guy. I can't do it.
Yeah.
Plus, I have a lot of control issues. And so I definitely want to be in control of my faculties when I'm out in the world, especially if I'm going to have to defend what I did later. I want to remember it really well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I had a girlfriend that didn't really drink until we were together. We were together when I started doing stand up, and I was drinking a lot. And so she tried it, you know, for the, you know, fourth or fifth time, whatever. She had drank before and didn't really like it. And so she drank however many times, just a handful, not very many. And she was like that. She didn't like the lack of control. And I was all about it, you know.
Yeah.
It made me feel taller and stronger, and you know, and more charming. All of the good, you know. And
yeah.
And so
it's almost like your insecurities are floating on the top of your brain, and then you start drinking, and it just eats that layer away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Along with a few other things.
Sure.
But but the things that were bothering you, I mean, it's like, oh, they're over there now.
Right.
And I'll pick those up in the morning.
Yeah, they'll be there, but for now, yeah, you can move them to the garage or whatever. And there was a lot of nervous energy that I had starting stand-up. You know, like I said, it was very exciting. And so it was calming of nerves, but also celebrating this new thing that I was excited to pursue, you know, and so, and we were in Vegas, you know, and so you could do it all night and it was cheap and, yeah. So yeah, it's funny how we can all be so different when it comes to every drug, you know, in both directions, you know, uppers, downers, everybody is very different. And so it doesn't feel like that for a long time. It feels like everybody can drink and everybody can smoke weed and make it work. And there's just a few people in the margins that are bad at it or predisposed to be addicted and to overdo it. And the reality is, you know, it's a lot more complex than that.
You really start thinking about it. And, you know, when you say it out loud a certain way, like, you know, most people are, you know, high functioning, like on drugs or drinking too much. But they go to work in the morning and, you know, they got kids and, you know, they handle their business. So they're probably fine.
Right.
It's like when you start thinking about it like that, it gets a little scary because it just seems like something that, you know, nobody should be really good at it.
Right. Yeah. Practice doesn't make perfect, but it can really cover up the impending, you know, doom. That is waiting for most people if they continue down.
You know, it's funny. I mean, we've normalized that, you know, but Kobayashi can eat 100 hot dogs and that's weird.
Right. Yeah. You know?
So I don't know. I mean, it's, I guess it is what it is. I mean, I'm not a biochemist who understands, you know, brain chemistry any better than anybody else. But, when you go through something like that, and I remember the things that I went through with my personal stuff. I also know that I'm a person who has bipolar, and so that's different than a lot of people. And so, when you're coming down, off of your years of decisions, and you decide it's time to do something different, I have to imagine that there was some negativity in your body pushing back to tell you something has changed and we don't like this.
Yeah.
And then how do you manage that?
The main things that happened when I quit drinking were I ate a lot more. Just kind of sweet tooth,
yep,
for sure. But also just kind of
got to get that sugar back.
Yeah, that's real. Yeah. And I was able to kind of feel better about that when I heard other people say that the same thing happened to them. They started eating a lot more sweets. I did that, and I stayed home more. It was tough to go to open mics and not drink because it was a very big part of my open mic going experience was drinking, because you're at a bar and there's a bunch of comics and they're all kind of, you know, nervous or anxious or excited. So there's just a lot of energy in the air at a lot of open mics, even if it's, you know, kind of sad or, you know, like a difficult Three Kings is a difficult open mic because there's usually not a bunch of supportive crowd members. There's a few people at the bar and they tune in and tune out, and then there's a bunch of comics who are worried about their own set.
In a way that's very beautiful. I mean, if you think about it, like if you can get a laugh in a room like that, you probably got something you should be working on.
That's what I got out of running the mic, and what has helped me feel good about it as a mic that continues to be there is, that there's something that you can gain from tough mics.
Yeah.
If a mic is really, well attended and supportive, that's fun, but it's not always going to be like that. The longer you do comedy, the more shows you do, they're not all fun and great every time. So, it's like going to a gym and working out. You know, you put in the stage time and you do the reps, then you get better, you get stronger, and it doesn't matter if there's a bunch of people there cheering you on, you're still telling jokes into a mic. You're still trying to, you know, go with the flow of the reactions that you're getting, good or bad, or lack thereof.
Yeah.
And it makes you a little bit stronger and a little bit tougher, so that you're ready when you have a tough crowd or a heckler or whatever. Those things, yeah, they are a little bit easier to deal with if you've just gone up anywhere, you know, a lot of times. But if some of those times are tough, or because, yeah, if you get a bunch of comics that are kind of paying attention to really laugh at some of your new stuff, then it's a good gauge. It's not automatic that a comedy club crowd will laugh the same way, because it might be a little too weird or random or whatever.
Sure.
Or those comics know you, so just, you know, because it's clever and new, they like it. But so there's not a direct correlation for the success to be, you know, similar everywhere else. But it does mean that there's something there.
But there is something that's in exactly what we're talking about here with these two facets of your life, that if you look at it, they're very, very similar, because you're in this difficult position, right, where you just quit drinking, and this was the thing that you knew. Like, this is one of the ways in which I relate to my friends. This is one of the ways in which I'm able to relate to other people who I don't know. This is one of the ways that I tap into this entire experience. It seems integral. Mm-hmm. And now this piece is gone, and there's a little chaos. So there's an unknown factor there. Much like people going up and doing an open mic, where people are not even necessarily going to be hostile, but even if the experience is going to be indifferent or negative or challenging, mm-hmm. in any sort of way, I feel like you can do one of two things when you bump up against something like that. You can either discover what the challenge is trying to teach you, and you can learn something really great about yourself and about it, and you can come out galvanized on the other side, more easier to deal with difficulty when it comes at you, or you shrink. And in your case, you came out galvanized in both aspects.
Yeah. Well, after, I shrunk and stayed away from open mics for like that first.
Well, sure.
There's licking wounds,
but.
Well, it was tough. And so it felt so foreign.
Yeah.
To not have at least a few beers.
Yeah.
At open mics and at shows. So it was a little bit easier to take a step back from the comedy world and to stay home with my girlfriend who had quit drinking.
Yeah.
And that kind of made me eventually feel stronger, so that I could go to open mics and not drink and not sure. have it feel weird, and to not chew my nails the whole time and leave immediately after my set.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a balancing act.
You knew that guy, the new guy that you had become, you didn't know him.
Yeah.
And so, it can be frightening to try to figure out, well, what is this guy going to do? And if you don't have any answers to that, it probably would have been a bad idea for you to throw this freshly naked Nathan, like, in the middle of this lion's lair, for a lack of a better term, and just wait for it to work out fine, because chances are good it might not have.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. There wasn't. I was lucky, again, to feel like it was relatively easy for me to stop drinking when I finally did. Mm-hmm. It wasn't easy the other times, because I didn't continue my sobriety. This time it felt more natural, like it was the right thing to do. But but my anxiety went through the roof, and it was harder to talk to a bunch of comics. Even if it was just, hey, how's it going? I got this new thing. Do you mind, listening when I go up? Or, can you do my show? And just any interactions were foreign without that. Like you were saying, without pouring some alcohol on my general anxiety or any, you know, social weirdness, you know, that, that disappeared after a few drinks. So it was raw, you know, to just sit there and just listen to people on stage and to think of my own jokes and to feel funny. It was all, it was pretty tough. But without the desire to drink, that didn't feel like an option. So it just, I think that made it a little bit easier to finally go out and be more comfortable. It took some time, and I wasn't around, like I said, for a lot of the first year. You know, I still ran my mic, and I still went to a couple of mics, but I took a big step back. And I was still signing up at Comedy Works. It wasn't like I didn't feel like I could do comedy.
Yeah.
But open mics in particular were tougher because it doesn't feel – I mean, you're not getting paid.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like a job. It feels like a social interaction and a you know, it's not a party because a lot of times they're not super fun.
Yeah.
But it's –
It is work though.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the crafting part of work that's no fun. I mean, a lot of people – that's why a lot of people fall away because in any sort of pursuit, you know, kids get guitars for Christmas and then, you know, by July they don't give a shit about the guitar anymore.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing. You know, it's like getting out there and getting out the tools – and getting those calluses on your hands or, you know, in this case, on your brain, on your material, getting yourself out there and going, all right, I'm going to workshop this in front of, you know, well, the four people at the bar who don't care and the eight comics at the back of the room with their arms crossed.
Yeah.
And I'm going to see what kind of reaction I can get out of this. It's like you go into that sort of environment knowing that that is likely the reality, but that it's also part of sharpening the tools, getting them ready, making yourself ready. And so, yeah, that's scary as shit. Why wouldn't you want to drink when you're doing something like that? And so to go into that sober, it takes more courage. It absolutely does.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, It was difficult, and it is
because you can dick around on a guitar by yourself in your room.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're not really going to do that with your comedy.
No, it is one of the unique things of comedy compared to a lot of other forms of entertainment is that you really need the live feedback to know for sure what parts work and what parts need to go away or whether it needs to be longer or shorter. All of that comes from audience reaction.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's... and you have to be comfortable showing people your work before you're done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also something most other people don't have to do.
Right. Yeah. You don't hear two thirds of a song.
Yeah. Bands don't typically do that. You know, get the notebook mics, out. Yeah. And...
Right. So yeah, it is unique to stand up and yeah, because it's a new joke, you don't really know whether it's good or not. I mean, the longer you do it, the better shot you have at being right, you know, at having a new thing pay off. But you can never, I don't think most comics can know that something is going to be good until it's worked a few times. Because even if something works the first time, it doesn't mean it will the second.
Right.
You kind of need to try it in a few different places to know, to be confident that you can tell it, you know, a bunch of places and have it go over the way you want it to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I focused on doing booked shows with stuff that I already knew worked and tried to get more comfortable with not drinking before I started. And I still don't do a lot of open mics.
Yeah.
I'm kind of spoiled, I think, because between running my mic and I usually go to Janae's mic at Janae Burrs has a mic at the Black Buzzard. I usually try to do that because I host a trivia night earlier in the evening, and so I'm already out.
Yeah.
And so it makes it easier to make myself go there than a lot of other mics where I would just leave the house in order to go do them. I should do more mics, but I used to do all of the mics, you know, and I think the longer you do stand up, you don't need to do every mic. You need to write new stuff and you need to work on it, but you don't always get something out of going to every mic every night. Sometimes it wears you down. It makes you hate comedy. It frustrates you more, or, you know, you're spending more money.
Yeah.
I've started to try and focus more on my relationship with Megan, because most of, you know, all of my other relationships came and went and comedy stayed.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times it was because I was picking comedy over working on the relationship, you know, or going out and drinking instead of staying home and hanging out, you know, and trying to communicate, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, even if a relationship isn't hard work, and it doesn't have to be hard work in order for it to be, fulfilling. I think some people have this idea that, you know, relationships are almost like a slog, you know, that, oh, it's hard work. It's really hard, but you know, well, it doesn't have to be, but nevertheless, there is an effort to having a real serious relationship with another human being in any way, shape, or form. There is an effort that comes out of you, and especially if you're a person who is very used to being the person to get validation from other sources, it can be difficult to remember how to listen and give and compromise and things like that. And those things are not really all that difficult of you, once you get your head in the right place. But it is still an effort. It doesn't have to be an effort that feels painful.
Right.
But it is still an effort.
Definitely.
You know, it takes effort to dance. You know what I mean?
It's like you were saying about being a good person. A lot of people are really bad at it.
Yeah.
And so the bar is low, but just reaching the bare minimum can be difficult, because it's not always fun or easy to do that work, to stay home or to talk, you know, or to speak up, you know, or to change, you know, for someone.
Yeah.
To try to be better for somebody, or to listen, like you said, to be better at being a partner instead of just kind of, you know, hoping that it'll work out if you just stay together long enough, or bailing if you feel like it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Because you probably could make it work if you focus, but you've got other things going on.
Yeah.
So you just kind of cut and run. I usually am with my partners for a while. I don't cut and run early, but there comes a point where it just disintegrates. And
do you just cut and run emotionally?
Well, it's like checking out, you know. It's like, you know, I'm not gonna, this isn't gonna last forever, so we'll see what happens. And then you're just kind of,
right,
you know, becoming more and more distant, or just less invested. And so that leads to more problems, you know. You know, once you start getting called out on your shit.
Yeah, because there's like a leak in the boat.
So, yeah, you're like, hey, that's me, or whatever, you know. So yeah, I don't miss making that same mistake over and over again. I've been with Megan we've been together over 6 years now.
Nice.
And it's longer than any other relationship I've been in. And it feels good to be confident that we're going to be together for longer, you know, that I don't see us breaking up. I hope we don't. I want to be with her.
Yeah.
And she has helped me so much, you know, by quitting drinking before me, by putting up with my shit over the years, and just kind of continuing to be supportive or helpful instead of doing like I have done and checking out, or, you know, just kind of hoping that the other person breaks up with you so you don't have to break up with them, and then they don't, so you end it, you know, or whatever, you know, or you sabotage.
So after all this time, and now that you've put yourself in a place where you have an understanding of how to navigate the world as the person that you are at this moment, how do you come at anxiety? I mean, is that still something that's an issue for you?
Oh, yeah. When I first quit drinking, I smoked more weed. I smoked a lot, you know, like a good amount every day for years and years. It was a part of my daily thing.
Yeah.
Hand in hand with drinking, but it felt so much less destructive and powerful.
Mm-hmm.
That when I quit drinking, I started smoking more weed, and that felt okay because I wasn't going to black out, you know, or become super aggressive or, you know, just so oblivious to other people or to right and wrong. And then eventually I wanted to smoke less weed too. It kind of didn't help with my anxiety. It could add to it. It could just bring certain random things to the forefront of my mind. As opposed to drinking, which, you know, dulled everything.
Yeah.
It could make me hyper aware of certain sources of anxiety. And so I've kind of backed off of my weed intake as well. I still smoke most days, but I don't smoke every day.
Right.
And I don't smoke nearly as much as I used to. And I like that. Because my general anxiety is lower, I think.
Right.
It's not, there aren't as many peaks of like high anxiety. I chew the shit out of my nails. I always have. So there is an underlying anxiety that's there.
Yeah.
That I don't know, you know, I don't know what to do with it. I've never gone to therapy, so I don't know if that would help, but I do try to process my own thoughts. I'm not constantly pushing away negative thoughts or concerns. I try to deal with them and process them.
Yeah.
I went to college for psychology, so I feel a little bit better informed than a lot of people probably do.
You probably are.
I mean, a lot of it seems so foreign, the way that our mind talks to us or makes us feel. And so I have tried to be aware of how that works, about how if I'm hungry or tired or if I drink too much coffee, it can make me think thoughts that I wouldn't normally think if I were just, you know, good. If I were if I were in, like, you know, the baseline state that you want, you know, where you're not hungry, you're not tired. And, you know, so generally I feel good in those times. And so when I'm out of whack, I try to tell myself that that's when I have racing thoughts or suicidal thoughts. It's probably because I'm stressed or tired or hungry or over-caffeinated, or I smoked too much of, like, a sativa typically will get me to have weird thoughts.
Sure.
You know, all racy thoughts. And so I try to talk myself down and explain stuff away because I went to school and was fascinated by our brains and our minds.
Yeah.
And how random we, you know, they can operate.
Yeah.
So I try to stay in control of that stuff. But yeah, I also just, I don't know how to stop biting my nails. I've tried. The only time I didn't bite my nails constantly was this 6-month period where I graduated college and I didn't get a job right away. I tried to get a couple of jobs and they didn't pan out.
Yeah.
But I also didn't need to get one immediately because I had a little bit of money from when I worked. When I was in college, I had a job. And I also got graduation money, not a lot, but enough.
Sure.
And I also moved, when I moved from Reno back to Henderson, I lived with my parents, so I didn't have rent.
Yeah.
They were they didn't charge me rent. And so it was just this period where I didn't have a lot of mounting concerns or a need to, like, stress about most things that we stress about. And so I didn't bite my nails, and it was great. But then I got a job and I moved in with the girl that I was dating, and I started doing more comedy, and they were all sources of anxiety, and so went back.
It's got to manifest itself somewhere. Why not in your mouth?
Yeah, there's something where just chewing my nails feels more natural to me than, like, smoking didn't take its place. I've smoked cigarettes before.
Yeah.
Never, like, constantly. Like, it can get some people. Like, I always drank way more than I smoked. And they go hand in hand for me, but it was very rarely did I smoke more than a couple cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
And more than a pack every 2 weeks or whatever. It was,
sure.
It didn't get me as much as it gets
that just other goes people. Right back to that wiring thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know? So I felt lucky to not have smoking have its hooks in me, but I also chewed my nails instead. And some people that smoke don't chew their nails, and some people don't do either, you know? and they you know, maybe they, you know, tap their foot a mile a minute.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just definitely have some type of general anxiety, and I think a lot of it has to do with thinking about all kinds of things, you know, at once.
Yeah.
What I'm supposed to be doing, the state of the world, what happens when you die, all that stuff is usually in my head, and drinking can quiet a lot of that.
Are you a person that can sit in silence at all?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I usually want the TV on, but I don't have to talk all the time, and I don't need somebody to talk. You know, I don't need to listen to somebody all the time. I can enjoy quiet, but yeah, I guess I typically don't. I usually have the TV on when I go to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the thought process that you're describing, I mean, I'm pretty familiar with that as well. But at the same time, it's like, you know, if I'm left with myself for too long with too much silence, it is not going to be good.
Right. Yeah. I suppose. Yeah. Some of those racy thoughts, they pile up.
Yeah.
If I don't have something on the TV to focus my attention, to kind of distract. From
that's not necessarily negative either. I mean, knowing yourself well enough to have the presence of mind to know that, you know, I'm going to turn on these old Laverne and Shirley reruns or whatever the hell is on it, whenever it is, you know what I mean? I just to have something there that I can put the focus on, because trying to unpack all of this baggage that is clearly there, some of these things are just ghosts. They're not real.
Yeah.
And some of these things are real, and I can't do anything about it right now.
Right. You have to go to sleep in order to wake up the next morning and function and try to work on the real things and to continue to ignore the negative. So, yeah, I have found that I'm not going to get a lot accomplished if I try to be alone with my thoughts late at night when I'm trying to go to bed.
Yeah,
it's not the right time, and I've gotten a lot of comfort in other comics and just every type of person sharing that they go through that as well.
Yeah,
when you try to lay down, you just get flooded with all of the things on your checklist, on your to-do list, on your goals, you know, and dreams and fears, and it's just too much for any of us to try and deal with when you're trying to go to sleep.
Yeah.
So, it's nice to kind of, you know, I don't feel bad about putting something on so that I can go to bed. And then hopefully, eventually, I get, during the day, I take care of some of those things.
Yeah.
That are bombarding me at night so that there's less of them. And I think I'm better about that as I get older and without drinking, because the drinking, you know, like we said, is just kind of pushing all that into a corner.
Yeah.
And hoping that you'll deal with it eventually. But it's tougher to do when you're blackout or when you're hungover.
Yeah.
Or when you're kind of, you know, focused on using that crutch over and over. It just kind of keeps delaying the time that you're going to sit down and take care of some of that stuff or take care of yourself at all. You know, you can just kind of maintain putting that stuff off if you keep drinking or doing anything that, you know, that prevents you from sitting down and trying to cross some of those things off and to get better or to,
yeah,
you know.
So it sounds like you figured out a lot of those things for yourself.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I definitely feel better.
Better is
overall
good.
about where I've come, and for a long time I felt stuck, and I don't feel stuck anymore. But I'm certainly not satisfied. I'm not completely happy with where I'm at. You know, I'm still bad about procrastinating about a lot of things and still get overwhelmed.
Well, you gotta have goals.
Yeah. But I don't feel as unhealthy as I used to.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking to me, Nathan.
Thanks for letting me talk.
All right, that is it for this week, folks. Be sure to check out his show, Off the Chain, Saturday, October 20th at Endo Brewing. It is going to be a blast. Speaking of having a blast, get yourself down to Three Kings and go to the comedy open mic. Support some local stuff. It's a really good time. Sign up starts at 6, so if you're a person who wants to see what you can do when you throw your fear in the garbage, sign up, get yourself on the list, try to tell some jokes and see what it's like on that end of the stage. It's actually really good for you, I think. Be sure to check out his podcast, One on Lund. I can't recommend it enough. And as always, don't kill yourself out there.